Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today I want to start by having you look at a map.
A map.
Yeah, but not a geographical map. A map of time. A map of how we think.
Oh, I see where you're going with this.
Right. Because you know how usually when we learn about the history of Western philosophy, there's this massive glaring hole right in the
It's a
middle.
great gap.
Exactly. We spent all this time in ancient Greece. You know, togas, Plato, Aristotle, the Parthenon, we get really comfortable there. And then it feels like someone just flips a switch.
If 500 years pass in the blink of an eye.
Yeah. And suddenly we're in the Middle Ages. St. Augustine, massive
Yeah.
cathedrals, heavy Christian theology. It just skips.
It is the classic jump cut of history. We really tend to treat those 500 years roughly from the time of Christ to the fall of Rome as if the intellectual world just, took a nap.
Right.
But the reality is that gap is where the actual wiring of the Western mind took place.
And that is exactly what we are digging into today. We're looking at a fascinating lecture series by Dr. Arthur Holmes.
A fantastic source.
Really is. He covers two very specific, very complex eras, Middle Platonism and Neoplatonism. And before you tune out, because those sound like, dusty textbook labels.
I do sound a bit dry.
They do. But let's be clear about the stakes here for you listening. Dr. Holmes argues that a group of pagan philosophers, people who weren't trying to be Christians at all, accidentally built the entire operating system for the Christian worldview.
Accidentally is really the perfect word for it. It's one of history's great ironies.
I mean, how does that even happen?
Well, these thinkers were trying to solve a logic puzzle, essentially, about how the universe is structured. They were pagans dealing with pagan problems, but in the process, they built a hierarchy, a really specific way of looking at reality that the Western world ended up using for the next 1,000 years.
So we aren't just talking about a history lesson today. We're talking about the hidden architecture of how we still process ideas like God, evil, and the whole structure of the universe.
Precisely. We are bridging the gap between a world that saw two realities and a world that saw one.
Okay, let's get into the stew. That's how Dr. Holmes describes this first era, Middle Platonism. A stew.
It's a great metaphor.
We're in the first and second centuries AD. The Roman Empire is at its height, the roads are open, ideas are traveling everywhere. And philosophy isn't just one school anymore, it's this giant mashup.
It really was a melting pot. You have the base, obviously, which is Plato.
The broth of the stew.
Right. But by this time, Plato had been dead for hundreds of years. His school, the Academy, was still around, but it had started absorbing other flavors, specifically two big ones,
Okay.
Stoicism and Neopythagoreanism.
Let's break those down because honestly, they sound contradictory to me. I usually think of Stoics as the, grit your teeth and bear it crowd.
Sure, Marcus Aurelius, emotional control.
Yeah, that sort of thing.
That is the ethical side of Stoicism, which is what most people know. But metaphysically, when they talked about the actual structure of the universe, they brought something much more important to the table. They brought the logos.
The logos. That's a heavy word.
It is. It roughly translates to word or reason, but for the Stoics, it was almost
Like what?
like cosmic software. It's the idea that the universe isn't just some random explosion of chaos. It follows a rational, orderly structure. There is a law woven directly into nature.
So if I drop a rock, it falls. That's not luck. That's the logos. That's the rational structure of the world doing its thing.
Right. So you take Plato's forms, the perfect blueprints of things, and you mix that with the Stoic logos, the law that orders the world, and then you add that third ingredient, Neopythagoreanism.
Pythagoras. Wait, the triangle guy?
The very same.
Okay.
But his followers later on were deeply mystical. They were obsessed with numbers, yes, but specifically with the idea of the one.
Number one.
They believed that reality flows down from a single source in stages, almost like a waterfall. They brought in the concept of emanation and hierarchy.
Okay, so you take Plato's perfect world, mix it with Stoic order, and add Pythagorean mysticism. And Dr. Holmes points out that this cocktail wasn't just, for fun. They were trying to fight a very specific enemy.
Oh, yeah.
A worldview called dualism.
This is crucial for you to understand. To get Middle Platonism, you have to understand what they are reacting against. At the time, the popular street philosophy, and specifically a group called the Gnostics, saw the world as a literal battlefield,
A cage match.
a total war between two opposing forces. On one side, you have spirit or mind,
Which is good, right?
which is good, light, pure, and on the other side, you have matter, the physical stuff, mud, bodies, dirt. And this was viewed as evil, or at best, just a chaotic mess that refuses to be tamed.
God, that seems like such a depressing way to live.
It is.
Thinking that the ground you walk on and the actual body you live in are actively hostile to your own spirit.
Exactly. It creates a completely fractured worldview. If you truly believe that, you try to escape the world, you hate the physical.
Right.
The Middle Platonists looked at that and said, no, that cannot be right. They wanted to move from dualism to monism.
Monism, meaning one reality.
They wanted a unified theory, one where everything, even the mud, even the dirt, ultimately comes from a single source and is therefore part of a good intentional order.
But there's a pretty massive problem there, isn't there?
A huge one.
How do you connect a perfect, pure God to a messy, dirty world without ruining the God?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if the perfect one touches the mud, does he just get muddy?
That is the exact dilemma. So to solve this, they used that Pythagorean tool we mentioned, the hierarchy of being.
The ladder.
Imagine a ladder. At the very top rung, you have God, absolute perfection.
Right.
At the very bottom, beneath the earth, you have non-being, total nothingness.
And in between.
Everything else. But not just random clutter. Dr. Holmes talks about the principle of plenitude.
Plenitude, meaning fullness.
Yes. The idea is that because the ultimate source is infinite and generous, it naturally overflows into every possible form of existence. There are no vacancies in the universe.
No empty rungs on the ladder.
None. So you have God, then you have high intermediary beings, maybe what you'd call archangels or minor gods, then lower spirits, then humans, then smart animals, dumb animals, plants, rocks.
Wow. It's a crowded elevator.
It is the great chain of being. And look, this isn't just some abstract diagram for a blackboard. This single idea governed the Western mind for centuries.
Oh, so.
It justified the entire feudal system. Kings are naturally higher on the ladder than peasants, who are higher than animals. It made social inequality look like a fundamental law of physics.
It's comforting in a way, I guess, knowing exactly where you stand in the cosmic pecking order.
Mm-hmm.
But even with this giant ladder, they still had what Dr. Holmes calls the distance problem.
Right. Because Plato's God, which he called the good, was becoming too transcendent. He was so perfect, so utterly other, that he was effectively unreachable.
And Aristotle's God was even worse.
Much worse. He was described as the unmoved mover, just sitting outside the universe, thinking his own perfect thoughts, completely ignoring us.
Yeah, that's not a God you can pray to. That's a God who just ghosted the universe.
Okay. Exactly. So the Middle Platonists had a dilemma. They needed to keep God up there transcendent so he stays perfect. But they also needed him to be down here, immanent, so the world actually has order and meaning.
They needed a bridge.
And this is where they reached back into that stew and pulled out the Stoic concept of the logos again. But they tweaked it. They started talking about logoi spermatikoi,
which translates to seeds of the logos.
Yeah.
And I have to say, of all the dense jargon in this lecture, yeah, that image is the one that really stuck with me.
It's a beautiful metaphor. The idea is that the divine reason isn't just a cloud floating over the world. It is planted in the world. Every living thing, every object has a seed of the divine reason inside it.
So the reason an acorn knows how to become an oak tree and not, say, a cactus is because it has that seed of the logos inside it.
Precisely. It allows God's intent to be inside the tree, directing its growth, without God actually being the bark and the leaves. It solves the distance problem perfectly.
God is present through his seeds, but he remains pure in his essence. It's like a remote operating system. The programmer isn't physically inside the computer, but his code is running everything.
That's a very Neoplatonic way to look at it.
Uh-huh.
Now, this need for a bridge, for an interface between the perfect one and the messy many, leads us to probably the biggest surprise in Dr. Holmes's lecture. And I think this is where you listening might do a double take.
We're talking about the Trinity.
Yes, we are.
Because usually when we hear the word Trinity, we instantly think Christianity. Father, Son, Holy Spirit is the defining doctrine of the faith. But Dr. Holmes outlines that these pagan philosophers actually came up with a Trinity first.
They did. But we have to be very careful here. The source material makes it clear they didn't come up with it because of divine revelation or scripture. They came up with it because of engineering.
Engineering?
Philosophical engineering. They were trying to bridge that gap we just talked about. They realized that a single, solitary, silent God couldn't interact with the physical world directly. He needed an active agent. So they developed a triad.
Walk us through the cast of characters in this pagan trinity.
At the very top, you have the Prometheus, the first God, the mind, the planner. He is the remote architect.
Okay, the architect.
Then, emanating from him, you have the Deuteros Theos, the second god. This is the Logos. He's the contractor. He's the active force that goes out and actually organizes the matter, creating the world according to the first god's plan.
And the third?
Usually the world soul, the raw energy that animates nature, keeping things moving and alive.
First god, second god, world soul. I mean, it sounds suspiciously like Father, Son, and Holy Spirit.
The structural parallel is undeniable, and historically, this framework was so incredibly useful that the Roman Empire eventually tried to use it to save themselves.
This was the part about Emperor Justinian, right, trying to rebrand paganism.
Exactly. By the 3rd and 4th centuries, Christianity is rising fast. And the old pagan myths, you know, Zeus sleeping around, gods stabbing each other in the Iliad, they were starting to look a bit silly and primitive compared to this highly sophisticated Christian theology.
Right.
So the empire tried to use this philosophical ladder to legitimize the old gods.
How did they do that?
They basically said, look, we aren't primitive polytheists. We believe in the one supreme god, too. But all those other gods, Apollo, Athena, Hermes, they are just intermediary beings. They are rungs on the ladder between you and the proto-theos.
That is such a clever pivot. We're not worshiping idols. We're just respecting middle management.
It was a very strategic attempt to make paganism intellectually respectable again. But as Dr. Holmes points out, it didn't work. Instead of saving paganism, this entire toolkit was co-opted.
The Christians took it.
The early church fathers, especially those in Alexandria, looked at this framework and realized it was absolutely perfect for explaining their own difficult doctrines.
You needed the vocabulary.
Exactly. When they had to explain how Jesus could be God, but also distinct from the Father, they didn't have to invent a new language from scratch. The Middle Platonists had already built the grammar. The church used terms like logos and hypostasis, which means substance, that were already floating in the air.
They didn't copy the theology, but they definitely borrowed the whiteboard.
That's exactly it. And speaking of Alexandria, that brings us to the next massive phase, the shift from this Middle Platonism stew to the highly refined system of Neoplatonism. And this centers on one of the strangest relationships in the history of philosophy.
We are talking about Ammonius Saccas, the man of mystery.
He really is a ghost in the historical record because he didn't write anything down, but he was a very prominent teacher in Alexandria in the 3rd century. And in his classroom, sitting probably just a few feet apart, were two students who would go on to change the world in completely opposite directions.
Who were they?
One was Origen, who went on to become one of the most brilliant and admittedly controversial Christian theologians of all time.
And the other?
The other was Plotinus, the father of Neoplatonism, and a completely staunch defender of paganism.
That is just incredible. It's like finding out that the Pope and the head of the Atheist Society had the exact same mentor in grad school.
It really highlights how deeply intertwined these traditions are. They share the same intellectual DNA. In fact, Dr. Holmes mentions that Ammonius Saccas was actually born a Christian, but left the faith.
Oh, wow.
So in a way, the philosophy he taught Plotinus, which became Neoplatonism, can technically be viewed as a Christian heresy.
A heresy.
In the technical sense, yes. It was a system that retained the complex structure of Christian and Jewish thought, the hierarchy, the Monism, but it completely deleted the Christ figure and reverted to pagan terms.
So let's look at what Plotinus actually built, because he takes this stew and turns it into a very rigorous system.
Yeah.
And the core of it is the fountain.
The doctrine of emanation. This is the defining difference between the pagan view and the Christian view, even though they look really similar on a diagram. For Plotinus, the world flows out of God like water from a fountain or light radiating from the sun.
Okay, let's play that out for the listener. Imagine you're a ray of light. You come from the sun.
Hmm.
But you are also inherently made of light.
Yes, that is the absolute key. In emanation, the product is of the exact same substance as the source. It's just weaker, cooler, and further away. This is called creation ex Deo, out of God.
And the Christian view is different.
Fundamentally different. The Christian view is ex nihilo, creation out of nothing. God speaks, and something entirely new comes into existence that is not God.
Like a carpenter making a table.
Exactly. The table is wood. The carpenter is a man. They are not the same substance.
But for the Neoplatonist, the table is literally made of carpenter stuff.
Yes. Which means Neoplatonism is basically pantheism. Everything is divine, just in a diluted way. Because everything flows out of the one.
Which sounds nice and spiritual until you realize the implication. Because if everything is God, then the boundaries between creator and creature just vanish.
And that is why the church eventually had to draw a very hard line against Neoplatonism, even while they admired the structure. They liked the ladder, but they couldn't accept that the ladder itself was made of God.
Now, Plotinus didn't just see this as a one-way trip, right? The water flows down from the fountain, but it also has to come back.
It's a continuous loop. He calls it epistrophe. The return.
The return.
Think about the psychology of this universe for a second. If everything flows from the one, then deep down, everything is homesick. Every single thing in the universe has a longing to turn around and climb back up the ladder to the source.
So gravity isn't just a physical force. It's nostalgia.
That is a beautiful way to put it. It is a cosmic homing beacon. And Plotinus maps this out in four distinct levels. At the bottom, you have us, finite souls and bodies.
Okay.
Above us is the world soul. Above that is the nous, the divine mind. And at the very top.
The one.
And here is where our language and honestly our brains start to completely break down. And Dr. Holmes spends some time on this. And it is totally mind-bending. Plotinus insists you cannot define the one. You can't even say the one thinks.
Wait. If it's the ultimate source of all intelligence, how can it not think?
Because thinking implies a split. To think, you need a thinker, a subject, and a thought, an object. If I say, I am thinking about a tree, there is me and there is the tree. That's two things.
Plurality.
Exactly. But the one is absolute unity. It has no parts. It has no internal division whatsoever. So it must be beyond thought. It must be beyond being.
It's so utterly simple that it breaks our ability to even describe it.
Definition requires boundaries. If I define a chair, I'm implicitly saying it is not a table. I'm drawing a linguistic border around it. But the one has no borders. It includes everything. So you literally cannot define it.
So we're just stuck. We have this ultimate reality at the top of the ladder, and we can't say a single thing about it.
Well, we can only say what it is not. This is known as the via negativa, the negative way.
Give us an example of how that works in practice.
Sure. We don't say God is limited. We say he is infinite, not finite. We don't say he is dying. We say he is immortal, not mortal. We don't say he is visible. We say he is invisible.
Immortal, invisible, God only wise. That's a hymn I grew up singing.
And that is the Neoplatonic legacy sitting right there in your hymnal. That entire way of speaking about God by stripping away limits rather than adding attributes comes straight from this attempt to describe the indescribable one. It was absorbed by Christian mystics and theologians. And it is still the standard today.
It's amazing to think that when we use those words today, we are echoing a conversation from a pagan classroom in 3rd century Alexandria.
It really shows that the history of ideas is a fluid river. We love to put things in neat little boxes, Christian versus pagan, Greek versus medieval. But the reality shown in the source material is that they stole from each other, they learned from each other, and they built on each other's foundations.
So we're left with this massive breathing system, a single reality flowing out from the one, trickling down through the mind and the soul into matter, and then yearning to turn back and climb the ladder home.
A beautiful cyclical monism, and it solved the exact problem they set out to solve. The one and the many were finally reconciled.
And as we wrap up, I want to land on one specific implication of the system that Dr. Holmes highlighted, because it's perhaps the most provocative idea in the whole lecture. It's about evil.
Ah, the concept of privation.
Yeah. Because if everything is an emanation of God, if everything's light from the sun, then what exactly is darkness? Darkness isn't a thing you can hold in your hand.
Right. Darkness is just the absence of light. You can't turn on a dark switch in a room. You can only block the light.
So for the Neoplatonist, evil isn't a force. It's not like a devil actively fighting God.
No. Evil is a privation of good. It's a lack, a hole. Think of a shirt with a moth hole in it. The hole is real. You can put your finger right through it. But the hole only exists because the shirt exists. You can't have a hole just floating in midair.
So evil is parasitic. It relies entirely on the good to exist at all.
Exactly. Or think of rust on a car. The rust is real damage, but it's a corruption of the metal. If the good metal wasn't there to begin with, the rust couldn't exist.
So what does that mean for us, practically?
It completely changes how we view badness. A dog isn't evil for not being a human. It just has less being on the ladder. But for a human, evil is failing to live up to your own form. It's a failure to be fully real. It's a failure to actualize that seed within you.
That is a haunting thought, but also strangely hopeful.
How so?
Well, it implies that pure evil is technically impossible.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you took away all the good, all the shirt, all the metal, you wouldn't have a monster left. You'd have nothing.
It suggests that reality at its absolute core is positive. Existence itself is good. Evil is just the failure to exist fully.
Which means, for you listening, think about this. The most evil person in history isn't the strongest or the scariest. Mm. They are just the emptiest. That is a truly powerful place to leave it. That's our deep dive into the hidden architecture of the West.
Thanks for exploring the ladder with us.
Catch you next time.